This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. Born in Sydney, this man calls Melbourne home and has been acting on stage and screen in Australia for over two decades. He is a NIDA graduate, and while he has had an extensive career on stage, featuring in some of the most iconic musicals like Beauty and the Beast, Cats, West Side Story, it was his role on TV and Secret Life of Us that cemented him as a household name. In an industry that has changed so much over the last 20 years, his role as Richie Blake as an openly gay man is still considered to be incredibly iconic. The role broke down stereotypes of what the Australian audiences knew about gay men, and it led the way for television networks to be inclusive of LGBTI characters. This man also made headlines when he married his partner before the same-sex marriage laws were amended. How exciting to have that now legitimised. But these days, this talented thespian works predominantly in performance art theatre in Melbourne, and while his back catalogue boasts that he is proudly Australian, he has been seen all around the world working in radio, TV and film. Over the last years, also crediting himself as a producer. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Spencer McLaren to Word for Word.
My dad was a singer, my mum was a model. Marriage institution is, you know, in my eyes, not originally a religious one.
A lot of the stories that came up originally, I thought were a bit iffy and a bit kind of cliched. And I was like, look, it's been done. Everyone's done that.
Transition that, you know, as a gay man I went through of having to come to terms with it yourself and deal with that external judgment or fear of external judgment of the world. Starting to lose
track of the week. Do you think that people did know your sexuality before you were aware of it? Do you think that that might have been a common thing?
Maybe the way people born under different star signs behave differently.
I made a decision not to have that kind of judgment and negativity around because it's just not positive. Thank you for having me.
It's quite a mouthful.
It is. Are we starting there? Is that the tone? Right.
It's so funny because, like, as the weeks have gone on, you sort of read out people's achievements. Is it strange to hear all of those sort of achievements being put into paragraphs?
Yeah, it is. You kind of feel like your life gets, in some ways you go, wow, that's a lot. Then you also kind of go, oh, is that it? Like, you know, it's condensed into like a minute. And you go, oh.
I think it'd be more that I'd be concerned that I left out big chunks of stuff that you've really loved doing. You know, and quite often do you do that. You sit down with people and you talk about their careers and what might have been headlines for media. And so what people remember, it's not exactly what you were passionate about.
No, and I think it's also, you know, things that, yeah, like I say, that you're passionate about and that took up a lot of time and were really personal projects for you that may not have been, you know, worldwide or national news. Some of your personal fondest memories as well, which, you know, don't always, you know, make that kind of list. So
I think for me, just because I did a reality TV show, that's the only thing people remember. They're like, where have you been for the last 6 years?
Yeah.
But because exactly. You don't sort of sit in someone's
aren't you following
moment.
Me on my blog?
You're not following me on Twitter?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you grew up in Sydney. What was your childhood like?
So I was born in Sydney and then dragged away to the UK until I was five, really. I don't really remember much about that. We were Birmingham, so there's some little memories, but not a lot there. It feels, you know, traditional. There was a staircase. We slid down it. Brother, mother, father, that kind of thing. And then really for me, Australia is my memory of my childhood. We were in Auburn, which is Western Sydney there. And I suppose you say it's normal because it was yours and you don't think it's any different to anyone else's. But obviously, you know, everyone has very different experiences. My dad was a singer. My mum was a model.
It explains the good looks.
Thank you very
much.
I don't
know where that Birmingham accent's gone, but anyway.
Yeah, no, it's gone. Thank God. I remember my dad as a butcher. And my mum as a housewife, really. I have distant memories of her being a model because obviously when she had children, that kind of faded away. We did a little bit of stuff with her every now and then, like a catalogue here and there and that sort of stuff growing up. But really, it was those sort of roles. And I remember revisiting my parents' history later on in life and also learning that my father was a race car driver.
Wow.
He was one of the original black and white minstrels. A singer and then a butcher and a pool salesman, you know. So I kind of go, okay, the things you don't necessarily know about their early lives in their 20s, etc. So
it's like, you know, he played all the parts of the village people.
Exactly.
The butcher, the baker,
yeah, exactly.
The candlestick maker. I don't think any of those were village people.
No,
anyway.
No. But I get the point there, yeah. But by the time I remember them, it was very down to earth and pretty straightforward. My parents did, however, divorce when I was 11. So the couple of years, that's imprinted on me quite heavily, you know, so that was kind of odd. My father remarried, moved in next door. That was a little bit odd.
The very next door?
Very next door, because it used to be, my grandfather used to live next door, and so he kind of took over that house, and, you know, a 7-foot fence went up, and he's going, this is all just kind of weird. You know, my parents didn't get on through the divorce process.
Did the wall get higher?
No, we moved to Melbourne. So, you know, the distance got wider. But part of my upbringing was also my father finding religion and becoming staunch Jehovah's Witness, which he's gone from atheist to Jehovah's Witness around sort of that sort of 12, 13 sort of time for me, which was fraught with problems and judgments and all sorts of stuff. And that continues to be problematic to this day for our relationship.
I guess religion is something that really is very personalized to someone, and then I think it becomes very important to someone, and so they can become very defensive of it if you have a difference of an opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, without judging from here, I'm not a Jehovah's Witness, I'm not religious, but it's very difficult when someone like your father or in that sort of role as a carer suddenly starts to impose judgments and views on you and your lifestyle, and particularly obviously as I've gotten older and, you know, married my husband and all those sorts of things, it continues to be extremely difficult and leaves a big distance between us. So he really wasn't present from, I guess, that sort of period, like 11-ish onwards. There was a real distance between us. So it just became my mum, my brother and I. And so then we moved to Melbourne when, I'm going to say year 8, I think it was for me. And we moved here to Werribee because Mum started a nail salon, and they had one in Bourke Street Mall at Cherry Lane.
Yeah,
if anyone remembers that, I'll remember that. And then one in Geelong down there. And so she got a map and went, "Well, Werribee's in the middle. We'll go there." And we got there, and there's like no houses. There's nothing. It was quite barren then. I've been back 5 or 6 years ago, and now it's like this lush trees and everything there. I'm going, wow, this is not how I recall it at all, you know.
They have the big shopping centres and things like that.
Yeah.
What did that do, though, to your relationship, I guess, with your father? Does that mean that relationship was really quite strained? I mean, is he still in your life?
Not really. I mean, we've gone through cycles. I mean, at that point in time, really, when we moved, I didn't particularly opt in to kind of go and visit. On occasion we would, but it was very strained. So really that whole period, there was the check-in obligatory phone call, you know, kind of once or twice a year, and it was all polite. But for me, you know, the arc of that relationship really, I guess, took a turn when I was at drama school, sort of doing, you know, the whole self-assessment reflective thing and looking inwards to understand your demons, your life, all of that kind of stuff, and use it for art. And I really wanted to revisit, you know, how we got there and understand what happened to my parents. Why did they divorce? You know, other than, you know, we fell out of love, inverted commas. Kind of like, I don't know even what that means to you guys, you know. So we delved into that a lot. And he and I had a bit of a reset at that stage where we thought we would attempt to, you know, agree to, I guess, disagree and find some common ground, because we obviously care for one another. And we started going forward in that direction. But as we got towards my engagement with my partner, which is now 5 years ago, I think it was.
You got married in 2014.
Oh, good, excellent.
My job to write stuff down.
Good to know. It's imprinted on my ring.
Your husband's listening to this right now. Yeah, come on, Spencer, like, you can remember.
Chris, that's his name, yes. Yes. So when we got engaged, I wrote to my dad and invited him and said, look, I'm not asking for your
approval
as such on this, but, you know, certainly not from a religious perspective. Mm. I said, because, you know, marriage as an institution is, you know, in my eyes, not originally a religious one. It's right now it's a civil and legal one. I'm not interested in the eyes of the church approving me. And I said, so I hope you can, you know, at least acknowledge this and share in this with us. And I got a letter back basically equating what I am, inverted commas, with pedophiles. And I was kind of, oh, this is great. This has gone so well.
So upsetting, though.
Oh, hugely, hugely.
Like, as in, I think it doesn't matter who you are, and sometimes the relationships between a child and the parent can be strained, but there's always that yearning to sort of not necessarily get approval, but certainly find it difficult when there is jaunt, very separate opinions.
Absolutely. And I think there's an innate desire, I think, to have a functioning relationship.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and I've gotten to a point now where I sort of feel, well, I kind of just have to let that go, I think, you know, because those sort of arguments that he put forward then, you know, are delivered with passion and caring about me and sort of saying, you know, I'm doing this because I love you, and I'm saying, but in the same token, you're also equating me with a pedophile. How is this possible? So we obviously had a very strong falling out for about 2 years, and since then we've had a couple of conversations. He's getting older now. He's, say, 78 or something like that, I guess. He's not in the best health. That's hard to deal with, but I also kind of look at it and go, there's not much I can do. It's kind of heartbreaking, but I made a decision not to have that kind of judgment and negativity around, because it's just not positive energy. And
you can only do so much, which is so strange to sort of say that. But you do hear your story and you think, well, you definitely invited him along and you've definitely tried to make an impact, and you have tried to sort of enforce some change in that relationship, where you hear of a lot of people who just close that door. So it goes to show that you're a very open person.
Yeah, and I've, you know, to my detriment sometimes, Chris, the husband, he's, you know, shakes his head going, why, you know, why are you having yet another conversation? And it's just...
It's who you
because,
are.
Yeah, and that is still my father. Mm. And, you know,
even though he's called you a pedophile, he's still there.
I just kind of go, there's, you know, there are things that are said and that, you know, I know he doesn't mean that, but okay, the fact that that's even in a sentence is distressing, and that you can even start to think about them in the same light is extremely worrying, you know.
I think in some circumstances, it's like the universe works itself out and you have a strong relationship with your mother.
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, a mum bringing up two boys, single mum, you do form a very strong bond, and we have. And yeah, it does balance out. And she's great. She's here in Melbourne, still running a nail salon.
Looking back a little bit, though, what were you like as a child?
what was I like? I think I kind of... I was thinking about how people perceive you just the other day, actually. And I was in the library playing Dungeons and Dragons with my friends. I didn't particularly play school sports. I was quiet-ish, you know, but not really introverted. But I think when I found music and started singing and doing stuff, that really brought me out of my shell. So I recall third grade choir was really exciting. I really enjoyed that. And I remember going on exchange to the US when I was 16.
Wow.
Into Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I was sitting in the office with the staff, like picking out, and my host parents picking out subjects, and they had like kind of glee choir on there. And I was like, oh, I didn't have the guts to kind of go, oh, I want to do that. You know?
Really?
Yeah. I was kind of like, oh, I don't know. And they're talking about sports and this and that. And I was going, oh, okay. And I thought, well, I'm here in America. I'm not going to play football. So I did sign up to do track, which was good. But then the music teacher walked in to that meeting just per chance and kind of said, no, you should do this. It'll be great fun. And I was going, oh, I don't know.
But you were really thinking, yeah. With Glee.
It was the best thing ever. And we had such an awesome time. I'm still in touch with her to this day. And so music really brought me out of my shell as a kid, I think. So
she'd be immensely proud. So that's why.
She's
so, like, you should see this guy that I was able to help with his career. You know, what was your first memory that you have?
The first things that come to my mind, because I've actually never played this game before. You know, what is the first thing I remember?
Why would anyone care?
But
it's still very interesting.
My grandfather's house and our house at the time had no fence before the 6-foot fence went up.
Yeah, right.
And we had a combined backyard. And I can almost see the 1970s Polaroid colouring sun on the grass and just playing in the backyard as a kid with my brother. So that's kind of the first thing that I can think of at the minute. So probably it, like, you know, must have been, because we left before I could walk, so it'd have to be 5, I guess, somewhere at that sort of age.
It's interesting that you bring up your brother at this point, because I'm always interested in the dynamics that people play within their siblings. What was your relationship with your brother like?
We fought like cats and dogs. So we're 20 months apart. And growing up, I have lots of memories of being pushed, poked, hit, peed on in the bath once. I was like, what are you doing? and just some really, especially when we got to be teenagers with just mum around and no kind of, I guess, alpha male sort of thing. We had some very physical, nasty fights. And again, it got to a point when I was 17 and we had a huge fight one day and I just said to my mum, he goes or I go, up to you, but I'm not coming back in the house till with him living there. And he ended up moving out.
At that point.
And that was, I think, a real turning point for us. And when we got out of that kind of environment, we started to really understand one another and almost become, you know, friends for the first time, if you like. And so since then, you know, which is now 20-something years ago, we've definitely become much, much closer. But, yeah, living in that environment.
Too much.
Yeah, and we were very different. He was a gym junkie, heavy metal, completely opposite. And, yeah, we just clashed massively.
You were talking before about schooling. So which school did you go to in Melbourne?
In my time, I went to 6 high schools. So
just collecting them with a
passport.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to, exactly. And in Melbourne, I started off at Werribee Tech.
Yeah.
Then we moved from there to Blackburn South. So I went to Blackburn South High School. And then I went overseas for a year. And then I came back. That had amalgamated into Forest Hill Secondary College.
Yeah, right.
So 3 of those. First one, Werribee, which is very different, being a tech school and being out there. There was no drama that I recall. I remember doing a computer course, learning how to make the turtle turn on the Apple IIe. And yeah, then when I got to Blackburn South, did the high school musical, which was South Pacific. So I was back on safe ground.
What was the thing that gave you the first bug into being an actor? Because people often remember that.
Obviously, I was singing during my 3rd grade choir. And then, but beyond kind of that, like in high school, like 7, 8, 9, I wasn't really doing any drama, no music, nothing like that. And it's really when I got to high school and did the school musical. And that for me suddenly showed me that this is kind of like a job. Mm. You know, you go, oh, people do this as a living.
I can make money from this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, this could be fun.
I could be Mel Gibson.
Yes. That wasn't the first thought, actually. So that's probably the moment where it kind of crystallized, because at that point you're also looking at career options and you've got to start picking electives for the next 2 years to go, oh, gosh, what will I do? And so obviously I chose 2 maths, science and English, you know, the obvious choice. Yeah. But that was really it. And then when I went overseas and did Glee then at the school, which was great. It was a performing show choir, so all choreographed and all that sort of stuff. I also did the school play over there. And then when I came back during year 12, I did 3 amateur musicals. So I kind of went, I'm doing everything. And, you know, I started having conversations with my mum, who was like, just finished school. You know, so I can leave now. I can leave immediately. She's like, no. Because I discovered around that time as well that apparently I could dance. because infamously there are no boys who audition for the musicals and certainly none who can dance, generally, as a rule. So I got in and obviously could dance. You know, I hadn't been trained at that point, but someone had said I had rhythm, so off I went. And so I really got cast quite quickly in these things and then finished school and started doing a full-time dance scholarship that I was given and then did my own singing classes on the side. And again, from there, very quickly ended up in professional musicals. So
I think for you, what strikes me, and I could be wrong about this, but I think it has a lot to do with you have a very masculine energy for someone who is gay, which means that it's easy for you to be cast in straighter roles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, doing dance, having that natural flair that was there, gave teachers or gave casting people the right elements to put you in a lead role. Do you think that that's the thing?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. I've been, I guess, interested in this perception of femininity and masculinity within the gay world throughout my life. And I was often mistaken as a heterosexual man all the time, you know. And I was like, how dare you? But it put me in some very awkward situations, I think, because I didn't quite know how to talk about being gay in those sort of circles at that age. And so I wasn't out at sort of 20 or anything like that. So I would just go along with whatever people assumed. And it makes it very possible to then play a feasible heterosexual in a musical or a film or a TV show or anything like that. Because I think regardless of your sexuality, you just have to be believable.
Exactly.
And we have ideas of what people are as a society, and they're not obviously always correct, but casting people will go for the stereotype. And so if you're playing a heterosexual lead in something like Footloose or West Side Story, you know, they expect you to have a certain kind of energy to that. And it doesn't have to be organic, but you have to be able to create it. And it's easier to do if it's organic.
If you've just tuned in, this is Word for Word, and we are currently talking to Australian actor Spencer McLaren. Do you know what's really quite funny about you is that, you know, you played an iconic character who came out on television, so people remember that, but then they don't necessarily know about Spencer. They don't really know, you know, how that coming out process was like for you.
Yeah.
How old were you when you first realised there were gay people? Not necessarily did you sexual experience or anything, but when did you become aware that that even was a possibility?
The first people I remember, friends of my mum's, back when my parents were together. I remember them having some parties and some friends of theirs being invited over who were gay. And I was just kind of like, oh, what is this, you know? And it was completely fine. And then a little later when my parents were divorced and mum had her nail salons, you know, she made friends with these people who they were probably... I was probably a bit older and able to understand it a little more. Mm. So I'm about 15,
right?
You know, at that point, 14, somewhere there. And obviously, you know, sexual arousal, desires, attraction, all that kind of are going through your body and system and all of that. And you're asking those questions and people go, do you have a girlfriend? And you're kind of like, oh, I don't really want one, you know. But that didn't really, I mean, I did date girls at school. I didn't date boys. I think by the time I was in year 11, I knew, but just didn't quite know what to do about that.
Yeah.
So
they started lusting after the people in the theatre camp rather than the football. Well, I guess more
after.
That's wrong, isn't it?
Hanging out with the theatre crowd, lusting after the footballers. No, not at all. Not at all.
So how old were you when you came out then?
Well, see, I didn't have to come out in the theatre world because...
It was assumed.
If you were a male in music theatre, everyone just assumed, you know, regardless of your... kind of energy, they would assume that you are gay. So that just kind of evolved. So I sort of had these parallel existences that were going on from about 19, and it took me a while to kind of bring them together. So I didn't come out to my mum until the end of first year drama school, and I had been dating a chap by the name of Brendan Moore, who some people may know as the host of The Renovators on Channel 10 and various other things. We're good mates still to this day, but I kind of... I would say 25.
Right.
And, you know, I kind of worked myself up in a little tizzy and sort of said to my mum, you know, I'm gay. And she was like, will you be upset if I don't cry? And I was like, no. And she was like, well, you know, I kind of guessed. And I was like, okay, you could have told me. Saved this whole stress. So she was really fine with it.
I like the fact, though, that she waited for you to come to her, because there is sometimes where parents will come to their children and put that pressure on them. And I like the idea of parents allowing their children to work it out for themselves and be comfortable enough to come and tell them.
I know, but I guess, and look, I must say, I did think to myself, she's got to know. She just got to, you know. She'd met some boyfriends, even though she'd known them as boyfriends before. But there's just that part of you that you just don't know what they're going to say. And I think because it was my mum and I was distant from my father, if she had gone the other way and really come down hard and said, this is unacceptable, this can't happen, this is wrong, if that had happened, it would have been extremely difficult to take.
Do you think that people did know your sexuality before you were aware of it? Do you think that that might have been a common theme?
Yeah, so I don't think so, but maybe I'm deluded.
No, I don't think so. Like, it's quite strange because, like, if I'd never been told, if it was never on paper,
yeah,
I probably wouldn't assume that you were a gay man.
Yeah.
And I think it's because you inhabit a lot of the traits that we have assumed through heteronormative behaviour that you have. And I don't know where that comes from. I think that's society or it could be my age, but it's certainly not something that springs to mind. I mean, you don't burst through the room to me as the campus man in town.
What's interesting is, as I was saying, this interest in masculinity and femininity, I did, for my sins, do about a year of psychology at Melbourne Uni and then just kind of went, oh, I'm just going to go and act. And I remember looking at the Kinsey scale, you know, where they kind of go, you're right, there's this and this. These are the two ends of the scale, and in between, you know, there's all shades of grey. And I also remember having a boyfriend in the UK at one point who was, you know, hyper masculine, and, you know, and then he got really shitty at people who would be overtly camp. And he would come out with statements like, you know, why do they have to run around and shove it down people's throats? And, you know, it gives people like me a bad name. And I was kind of, I said, well, what are you talking about? And suffice to say, we broke up. But my case with him was, I just sort of looked at it and said, if you're so worried about that being the image of the gay male out there, then why don't you put your hand up and say, I'm also gay and there's diversity here. We're not all camp. We're not that. He said, why should I have to? I'm like, because apparently this is giving you the shits. And it got me thinking a lot about it. And my kind of take on it, you know, obviously growing up and trying to work out how do I cope in these situations, because people assumed I was straight, I kind of didn't correct that. And so I would, I guess, I don't know if I hung on to it, but certainly stay with that kind of behavior pattern, because it meant I didn't have to deal with confrontation. You know, eventually I got to a point where I can't do this anymore. But at that time, I didn't want confrontation. And I wondered often whether overtly feminine people would also use that behavior. And that has evolved, because also if people who are worried or concerned or judgmental or hateful can see from a distance that that's a person that's gay because they're making assumptions based on feminine behavior, then they may not go near them. So it's like a defense mechanism to say, if you don't like this, don't come near me. You know, it's like an early warning signal. So you don't get in a conversation with a girl who's trying to crack onto you, because she would know straight away, maybe not. You know, so I often wondered whether that was how these behaviors evolved in an organic way, not a conscious choice from anybody, but
I don't know. Like, it's interesting because the thing for me is, where does the gay voice come from? You know, that I'm like, because I'd love to be able to have a more masculine voice. And it's so funny that that's a pressure that I put on myself. But I wonder whether or not role models as you're growing up, or the sounds that you make as you're talking, come from maybe your parents in some way. I honestly listen to sometimes me talking and I can hear my mum's voice in it. So I think that maybe from an early age, without actually being aware of it, I was emulating that. There's certainly different backstories to different gay people. But what has been interesting to see over time, and I think more so recently, is how many different stories there are about gay men, or how many stories there are about gay women. And the LGBTI landscape seems to be growing, and there isn't just one way. You don't go, oh, you're a lesbian, so you're butch, or you're a gay man, so you're effeminate. I think we're starting to think that, you know, it's okay to be different.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, with the development of, you know, gay marriage now and the I think you used the word legitimization that comes with that. You know, I feel like we are every generation moving towards a completely morphed and blended society that just goes, you know, we don't have as many gay clubs as we used to anymore, particularly in Melbourne. I find, you know, the need to have a gay bar, you know, originally because it was a place you could go, you weren't safe in other places, that's vanishing. You know, that organic need that I guess spawned their initial development, you know, is gone. So there's nothing wrong with a gay bar. I'd go straight back to one always wherever we are in town and go, let's go, because they're great fun.
Yeah.
You know, but you still, there are less and less of them.
Exactly.
And we're just moving into a blended environment, which I think is great.
If you could go back and give some advice to Spencer as a 12-year-old, what would you say?
Okay, 12-year-old, I would say the yellow and grey cords need to go. I can see those now, like, yeah, at the Blue Light Disco.
Is that Corduroy? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, cords. Yeah.
They gotta go.
They were two-tone. They were Lightning Bolt, I think was the brand.
Hideous.
And I had a matching jacket. Anyway, that's neither
double
here nor
denim.
There.
Didn't you? Yeah, didn't you do double denim for a while?
I'm sure I probably did. Chambray and denim, perhaps. You know, double denim's dangerous. But I mean, what would I say? Gosh, the best thing you can do is not worry about other people's opinion of who you are, and learn who you are. And just be proud of that as soon as you can. It's that transition that, you know, as a gay man I went through of having to come to terms with it yourself and deal with that external judgment or fear of external judgment of the world that was so consuming for such a long time, you know, where you just went, I just don't know what people will say, you know, my school friends, and what will they say? What will they say? And worrying about it, when one of the things I've certainly learned is that worrying doesn't do any good.
Your stories wake people up. I think people are incredibly drawn to you. What do you think it is about you that makes people so drawn to your storytelling, your art, I'd say?
I don't. I've never thought about that, to be honest.
Because there's a certain level that goes to acting. I mean, obviously you're playing characters, but people have to be drawn or curious. Or...
Look, you know, I mean, I watch shows like X Factor, this kind of stuff, and go, what makes the difference between a great actor and an average or a bad one? I mean, I've taught acting as well, and it comes down to truth, and it comes down to openness, which some people would call vulnerability, and letting down your guard. And acting for me, you know, whilst I was worried about how people would think about what they would think about me and that kind of thing, when I'm acting, it gave me the freedom to do anything. And so I could be at ease and bring to the fore all of those emotions, feelings, etc., that I may not be game to acknowledge too openly, you know, fears, vulnerabilities, worries. I would easily draw on those, because at the end of the chapter I could go, oh, that's a character, you know, and put that over there, you know. And so if anybody did something, that's, I had a safety guard there that I could say, that's the character, not me, you know.
You've been on lots of shows. Home and Away, Secret Life of Us, All Saints, McLeod's Daughters. But your stage work is also continuously impressive. What's your first paid acting job? How old were you?
I did a little guest role in a show on the ABC called Halfway Across the Galaxy and Turn Left, which I'd done the odd extra gig here and there, but that was my first kind of speaking role, doing stuff there. And I was an alien with very large hips, if I recall. Like,
how did
padding
they make those? Oh, they padded you out.
Yeah. You know, RuPaul style, you know. we were making Herstory there. That was my first, kind of paid professional job.
What was the goal when you started out? Did you think when you started out, I want to be a stage actor, a screen actor? I mean, did you really know, or did you just want to do acting?
I think I just went, I'm going to Hollywood, everybody. Hollywood, here I come, because that's the thing you see mostly. You know, I didn't, television and film you see all the time. You know, it's so easily accessible. I'd been to theatre. I was obsessed with Camelot, the musical, which I'd seen when I was 12 or something with my grandmother. I just went, that's amazing. And I'd done musicals and things, but I didn't know Broadway stars, you know, and I kind of knew of some theatre stars here. Anthony Warlow, obviously, yeah, that's there. But when I was young, I went, oh, you know, I'll go to Hollywood, that's what I'll do, you know. And I auditioned for NIDA when I was 19 and didn't get in. And they said, look, you know, I got through, I think, to like the third round or something. They said, you're great, but you don't have the maturity to do this yet. You need to go and live life and then come back. And I kind of went, you can get Like, I know what I'm doing. And, you know, 7 years later, I went back and I didn't spend those 7 years thinking, I've got to get back to NIDA. I actually just went off and did stuff. So, you know, and ironically, even though I thought I'm going to go into Hollywood and do all that, musicals were my first break because they were tangible. I went from the local dance scholarship into musical auditions, sing class. Mm. It just kind of evolved. It was very tangible and close, whereas I didn't have any connections to the film and television world. I had an agent who'd got me that one kind of gig, and then I went into musicals, you know, and my first one I did was West Side Story. Really, I think it's less so now, but for a long time, casting agents would have separate different files, television actors, leading actors, theatre people, you know. So there was a real discrepancy here between respect for the craft on stage translating to screen. Mm. And so because I spent so long in musicals, you know, and the way they book and cast jobs, television's instantly and theatre has a long lead time, so they're not very compatible. You kind of have to jump from one to the other and get on that train for a while or that train. So I went from West Side Story, and then I did professional musicals for about 5 years and went from job to job to job to job. And I'm like, this is fantastic. I'm having a great time, you know, climbing the ladder, doing some lead roles, that kind of stuff. So this is really great. But then I got to a point where I just went, it's not enough. I don't feel like I know my craft well enough. Mm. You know, I'd done singing, I'd done dancing, I'd never studied acting. So then I did go back to NIDA and said, I want to do this. And at the time I was doing Beauty and the Beast. And they kind of said, why do you want to be here? You've already got an established career, et cetera. And I said, yes, but I don't understand, you know, the craft of what I do, and I want to understand it. And I was working with people like Richard Werrett from STC, famous director, Ian Judge from the UK, RSC, and I didn't feel confident to have a conversation with them about character.
But hang on a sec, at the same time, weren't you understudying for Hugh Jackman in Beauty and the Beast?
Yes, and The Beast as well. So, yeah, and I was just, I just went, I want to go and do this. And Hugh actually was one of the people, he'd come out of Whopper and said, you should go and do it, it's amazing. So that was another encouraging step for me. So I auditioned and got in.
How was the NIDA experience for you?
It was great. It was life-changing as a person and obviously from a career perspective as well.
Does it still have a place, do you think, NIDA? Do you think you're Absolutely. Still saying to people, go back and study?
Absolutely. I what I say to people is NIDA, or any drama school for that matter, is not the only place you can get training. You can absolutely get training in the real world, on the job, from experience, etc. But what NIDA gives you is an intense, focused period where you're working on, you know, 4, 5, 6 projects within 1 year, and you have the luxury of just intently focusing on the craft.
And then coming out of NIDA, where was your head at? Did you mainly want to stay in theatre?
I went straight on to Home and Away.
Didn't you nearly marry Kate Ritchie?
I did nearly marry Kate Ritchie.
How did that not work out?
That did not work out well. We met backpacking, obviously. I was playing Kieran Fletcher. She was playing Sally Fletcher. We had the same surname. We got booked in the same room by accident. Oh, my God, it was amazing. I came back. We were engaged. I was cheating with Gypsy. We got to the altar. And then Al ran me out of town. So it was awkward, but it was great. It's about 6 months we did that for. And then that's when I also landed the job as on Secret Life of Us.
Wow.
So doing the pilot, Secret Life of Us. So I stopped doing Home and Away, went on to Secret Life. And the rest is history.
What was it like getting that role? What was that memory like?
Well, it's interesting in the context of the conversation we're having. First of all, getting the role was absolutely amazing because it was a TV show that everyone was talking about because it was touted as the Australian equivalent to This Life Meets Sex and the City. Claudia Carvin was attached at that point and Joel Edgerton. So, you know, some high-profile Australian names. And I remember we had done a reading for some roles during my last year at NIDA. They often do a kind of a workshop with casting agents. And it had been cast, this role. I was not available initially. I was doing Home and Away. Then, as they always do, Project Slide, the guy who they had cast as Richie took a role on Days of Our Lives or something like that. And so he had pulled out of that role, and so the role became available. I went in and auditioned and read opposite Abby Tucker, and we had a really great audition, and Abby's a really fantastic actress. She's so organic, so it got really kind of intense in the moment. I was like, oh gosh, okay, but we went with it. And I remember pulling over on the freeway because my agent had called, and I kind of got the call. I was like, oh my God, what does this mean? She goes, well, it means you're doing this, and then this happens. But it was only the pilot at that point, not the whole series. It hadn't been optioned yet. So when we shot the pilot, the character was 100% straight.
Did you have any idea they were going to turn that character gay?
Nope, none at all, none at all. Once the series got commissioned to go ahead, we had a meeting with the writers and producers and my agent, and they came in and said, we want to talk to you about changing the nature of this role, turning him into a gay character. And I was not out. I was certainly not out to them or anyone I'd worked with on that show. And my agent and I sat down and had a very, detailed conversation is the best thing to look at, because it was deeply concerning for me. I found it very confronting, going, oh my God, everyone's going to know I'm gay. What does this mean? And it really freaked me out because I wasn't ready for coming out publicly, or especially not on television. I was like, this is not how I saw this going. And the one thing that I said that decided the job for me was, if I was straight, would I take this role? And I said, yes, I would. So I went, the role is important and it needs to be done. It should be told, I'll deal with my own issues as and when they occur. So we took the role and I just went, oh my God, what am I doing to myself? I do remember I came out at work with our producers and writers, I think after season one.
Yeah.
Because they're often saying, oh, you know, are you okay? I was going, yeah, I'm fine. It's all good, you know. But I didn't really have a lot of conversations about people I was dating or anything that was going on. And then at our wrap party, I said, you know, I've got to go because I've got a date. They go, what's her name? And I'm like, Adam. And they're like, ah! And I was like, yeah, have been the whole time. They're like, what?
That's amazing. Like,
yeah, so it was quite funny.
I remember watching the pilot and thinking maybe Joel Edgerton's character was gay. He seemed more gay than you did. Isn't that funny?
Look, we've all played Spin the Bottle.
Have you kissed Joel Edgerton?
No, I haven't actually, but others have.
Okay. You know? If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Word for Word, and we are currently talking to Spencer McLaren, who is an Australian actor. What did you think of the writing of that character, Richie, when you were sort of now a gay man and being able to explore his genuine story? What did you think of him as a gay man that you were playing?
I would often have conversations with Amanda Higgs, producer, and Judy McCrossan, writer. They would write stuff. And I would say most of the time they got it right. You know, I don't know where they're researching, you know, what she's doing, what, you know, how she's getting that information. But she did a really good job. But there are some times when I would just come in and say, I just don't buy that, you know, and this is why. And they were great. And they would listen and we'd have conversations and discussions about it, because we all want the same thing, which was absolute authenticity.
Did you have input on story arcs?
To an extent, but really, you know, they were definitely in control of what they wanted to do and say with the show. But they were certainly open and always happy to listen and hear ideas. And, you know, if it enriched anything, they would certainly add them in. You know, you'd often find some of the more the little tidbits that would happen on the sides, and that you'd kind of go, who's been talking to you? Because that's the conversation I had with Sibylla last week.
Yeah.
And why is that now in a script? You know, so there's some funny little things there that you went, okay.
Was the writing back in early 2000 stilted from what LGBTI characters are being portrayed as now?
I think that there's two things. One is Australian television and one is international production, in that at the time we did Secret Life of Us, we definitely felt like we had delivered a show that had broken down barriers, moved us forward as, you know, a cultural society, I guess, in terms of what we're watching and doing. And I think we all expected the rest of the industry to then leap on the train and follow with this astonishing new material that's coming up and evolve and grow. And I feel like when Secret Life stopped, we just doubled the amount of police shows that went back on television. And we always kind of went, that's not where I saw this going. Since then, obviously, you know, there's some stunning television being made now out of this country, which is absolutely brilliant. Yeah, getting to your question about, you know, whether there's more of an authenticity now, I think stylistically, any show in 2000, I just actually saw about 20 minutes of Sex and the City last night and went, oh my God, I hate these women. What's going on here? You know, it's kind of dated. You know, our style across all television, all acting has evolved immensely. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's just how we're approaching gay characters, but I certainly think we have evolved and we see more diversity in the style of character. Sure. It's not just the tokenistic, you know, gay best friend anymore. But yeah, we've certainly evolved a lot.
How did the general public respond to you in that role?
obviously that whole period of going from people not recognising you to people recognising you was very weird and strange. Mm. I do remember discussing this particularly with Deb Mailman, and we'd come in and go, how are you? I'm okay. Are you okay? I'm like, yeah, because you just feel like a weird animal that everyone's looking at, and you think, is something wrong? What's happening? Am I in danger? Ugh, it's just very off-putting. But once you kind of got past that and strange people walking up to you and kind of got used to that as a concept, generally people would get angry at you for stuff your character is doing. And they would go, oh my God, how could you do that to her? And I'm like, I have to think, what are you talking about? How many weeks behind are you? Oh, you've just seen episode 4. Oh, don't worry, it all gets fixed, you know. So they'd come at you like that. I would sometimes get guys in bars, straight bars, come up and say, oh, you're not really gay though, are you? And that was a bit kind of odd. And in the first year, obviously, you know, being in the closet with my friends and certainly not out in the media, I wouldn't particularly talk about it. And then as the show went on, I kind of went, this is stupid. You know, we need to talk about this and stop hiding.
How did the gay community respond to you playing this role?
Hugely positively. I mean, even now, you know, I get random emails or Facebook messages, you know, or you run into people who talk to you and thank you for portraying that character, you know. I mean, it was really, really wonderful to have been trusted with that role, you know, and being in that position to be able to play someone that people can look at and relate to and feel like, oh, I'm not weird, I'm not wrong, I'm not odd, you know, there's an example finally I can look at, you know, and see a character that's like me that's gay and yeah, even though he was often troubled and whatnot.
Did you relate to that character at all?
I mean, playing an actor who's coming out as gay, I was kind of, well, this is quite relatable. Yeah, certainly. And I mean, he had his own little nuances, obviously, but it was often the thing I just go, okay, where are our differences? You know, what does he do that I don't do? But yeah, I did relate to him a lot.
What was the chemistry like between Samuel Johnson and Claudia Carvin?
Samuel was difficult. Sam was very much his character. You know, no shoes, bumming around, fly by the seat of his pants. You know, he brought an absolute realism and authenticity to that. I'm like, have a shower, Sam, please do. You know, love him to bits. And so I think he was kind of the loose cannon amongst the team, you know. But it brought a particular energy to that group,
yeah,
you know, which
sure.
was vital and important.
Portraying LGBTI characters and themes, has that always been prevalent for you? I mean, did you set out to want to delve into that or still?
No, not at all. I just wanted to play interesting parts, you know, and as I evolved and started to understand the motivation between why I did what I do, it really becomes about wanting to affect people for me and have an impact on them in some, make them feel something, whether that's laughter, whether that's anger, whether that's remorse, whether it's self-reflection, but engaging with them in some way that isn't just them watching.
Do you think there's a lack of representation of gay characters on screen?
I guess it depends on how you judge that. And I go, if what's the latest stat? We make up 10% of society. I don't feel like we're deeply underrepresented, maybe marginally. 18 years ago, yes, absolutely. You know, now less and less so. But it's important to continue to be aware of that.
Australian screenwriter Sarah Walker was told that no one wanted to see gay people on the small screen in prime time, and that she was only told that 6 years ago. Does that shock you?
No.
Can you imagine sitting there and, you know, like, as I guess for an actor it's different to a writer or a producer, but I guess you've at different points worn different hats. But is it shocking to think that people are having that conversation and saying...
No, because I think that the people who make those kind of statements and the decisions that are relating to those roles are ultra-conservative and they are worried about things they shouldn't worry about, and I think it becomes less and less relevant. But they're driven by, you know, selling ads in the breaks and will the network screen this, because the network will be ultra-conservative, you know. But you've just seen the ditching of Roseanne's show on ABC, for example, which shows you how far we have come. That whole thing's in the can, paid for, done, ready to go. millions and millions in investment. Previously, they would have run it, changed the time slot and still run it and done that. And just gone, oh, yes, yes, we support that, but we've got to deal with our investment. We're not going to waste it. They've gone, nut, we're done, in the bin. You know, so I think now we're starting to get there, but 6 years ago, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
It's so interesting, though, because you think about it. What is the relationship between these two things? Back in the day, Roseanne and Bill Cosby on television and have always, now that we know this, been controversial, and then their backstory has really caught up with them. Do you think that there's a possibility that now with Twitter and social media, we get more of an insight into who those people are, these megalomaniacs in a way, drunk on probably their own power? Do you think that that's putting an end to that kind of behaviour?
I'm not sure it will put an end to it. I wish it would, but social media gives us an insight into people, and what you have to realise now as a public figure is that you don't have the control you used to have about what people can and can't see, especially if you're going to run a Twitter account where you are quite vocal about your opinions and things like that. You can not have one and you can control in that sense, but even so, you know, the amount of imagery around everybody around, you just know a lot more about a person than you ever used to. So it's important to have an authenticity as a person that, or a profile that flows through into the characters. You can't just draw a line and go, well, I'm an actor, my life is irrelevant to the character. Mm. Because really, as you can see, that people don't just go and watch for the art. It's how they sell a ticket, you know. Tom Cruise starring in, or Charlize Theron starring in, you know, you go, oh, I like that person or what I know of that person. So if they do something really horrific and incongruous to your belief system, you're going to not watch them in the same way.
What sort of stories and themes do you seek out now as an actor?
I'm drawn to human stories. Mm. I would like to grab a machine gun and dodge bombs once, just to go, did that huge big action film? That'd be great. I would just say human stories with a character that goes through change, you know, that goes from here to here, some kind of lessons, has something to say. If I had the luxury of choosing those all the time, I would.
We've been on a real journey with what sexuality means in Australia, and it's been a roller coaster over the last few years. What impact did the marriage equality campaign have on you? Because obviously you got married before the laws were changed.
Look, it's one of those areas, you know, I'm sure we all felt as a community, where there was deep injustice, you know, kind of happening. I put together Ate the Play, which we did at Her Majesty's Theatre with an amazing cast to raise money for the campaign, which is incidentally when I got engaged as well, because at that point, you know, whilst I think I've been together with my partner for, what would it be then, maybe 6 years, I hadn't particularly planned to get married, but going through the process of that play and the political environment that was going on, it just felt like the right thing to do. So it's something, you know, you can get very riled up about and angry about. And so that campaign, you know, from when it started to when it came to be, went through waves of, you know, I guess, activism where I was doing things, and times when you're weary and just go, is this not going to happen already? Because, you know, 2008, I think it was, it's inevitable, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. But when it did come to be, it was such an emotional time. Like, we went down to the State Library to hear the plebiscite result. It's only at that moment when it was, you know, yes, that I realised how much it was still a part of our lives and how desperate we were for that legitimacy, you know, because it was such a huge relief to be backed by the Australian people and recognised and understood.
What was it like to then get the letter of recognition? So once marriage equality had happened, and you've been married a couple of years before, what was that moment like?
It was great. It was great. I mean, for us, we went, because I'm also a British citizen, as soon as it became possible, we went to the British consulate here in Collins Street and got legally married in the UK, which was about a year and a half before it was legalised here. Mm. But just getting that through and then just going, we're actually legally married here, it just makes life easier, simpler, and it's just wonderful to have that level of recognition and acceptance, not tolerance.
Well, you're a storyteller, you know, so I think, you know, more people need to tell these stories. Do you have a message for the queer community that is listening to this right now?
Go and see Puffs the Play at the Alex Theatre, which is running right now. That's what I say. It's all about the underdogs. Go, starring Rob Mills.
I love Rob
That's
Mills.
My latest project, so that's that one there.
I was reading a lot of the reviews for it as well. There's very positive reviews.
It's not just a piss take of a certain boy wizard, you know, who went to a certain school of magic and magic. It actually has its own story to tell, and so it's great.
And I think we do need to tell more stories that are positive and funny. And in Australia, where we've sort of struggled with that and telling stories of gangsters and robbers and very bleak stories,
yeah.
I think it's important for our...
Something positive into the world.
Well, so. I want to thank you so much for being able to take the time out and be on Word for Word. I'm sure there's lots of people that have listened to your story today and felt it incredibly inspiring and relatable.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.